Children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education.
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. We have some panelists and folks coming into the studio, and we'll introduce folks in a second. We're going to have a caller on the line talking about recent as well as a longer perspective and context on gang activity here in Santa Cruz, the city specifically, responding to some countywide stuff as well. But, you know, we're going to focus on the city of Santa Cruz here, so stay tuned. You gotta hustle from the bottom just to feed the poor. Said it's a class war. Said it's a class war.
Fuck yeah. Class conscious. Class conscious. Class conscious.
It's a class war.
See it loud.
Said it's a class war. It's a class war, it goes on every day. People getting paid in a crazy way. It's a class war. Said it's a class war.
Class war.
Monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay.
Class conscious. Class conscious.
Mala vista.
Class conscious. Hip hop.
NBC News In Depth tonight, back to the front. The number of U.S. soldiers who've had their Iraq military service involuntarily extended under the so-called stop-loss policy is at its highest since the start of the war. That's despite a Pentagon pledge last year to cut back on its use. NBC's Jim Mikleshevsky takes a look at the effect of this controversial policy.
As Sergeant David White was preparing to wrap up his military career last year, he was stunned when the Army refused to let him go.
I was just in disbelief. I did not think that something like that could happen to me.
Instead, White was sent to Iraq for his second combat tour, leaving wife Crystal and newborn Eva behind. What the Army did is slap White with a stop loss, which allows the Army to extend the soldier's enlistment, like it or not.
Yeah, I did a good thing. I'm back from Iraq. I served my country. The only thing on my mind right now is to get down and serve big time with family. What a house man rocking the fruits of my labor. That 14 months of Iraq behavior. Better lurk, stay alive. Shoot that fucking caper, no doubt. I was making that Iraq paper. Now I'm ready to get on out. Become a civilian again and get on out. No car payments, house all decked out. Till I'm set to motherfuckers scream and shout. But success got cost, the army got forced. Telling me a nigga like me is stop lost. That means I can't get out, my salad got tossed. They fucked me over like a mob boss, high horse.
58,000 soldiers have been stop lost in the past 6 years. Their service involuntarily extended from a few months to more than a year.
So don't tell me, hey, that's life, motherfucker, cause you can't get sprayed. What a good behave. Nah, this is real days. When shit hit the airwaves and somebody gotta say, fuck you, colonels, captains, E7 above. You think you're so much bigger than I am? I've been too good of American.
Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. We've got a couple guests in studio as well as a caller on the line. Tomas, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Tomas Alejo is a member of the Watsonville Brown Berets, and welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's a pretty familiar frequency for you.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Our show is every Saturday night from 6 to 9.
Wonderful. And guests in the studio, I'll ask you to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Holly Nelson. I teach at Natural Bridges High School and Green Career Center on the west side of Santa Cruz.
And a downtown employee. however that works best for you.
I work at a downtown restaurant and bar, part of a company that owns a couple bars downtown.
And so we're all here. Everybody, welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
Here to talk about and discuss what to read the papers sounds like a recent surge in gang violence, but to some folks who have worked with youth and worked on the streets in Santa Cruz is a little hill, a little uptick, a little spike, but something that has some history and some context that maybe is getting missed. With a lot of people up in arms about a couple of significant recent events. But I wanted to start by asking Tomas, if you could talk just a little bit briefly about specifically Santa Cruz here locally, not in terms of the county, but the city. How long, some of these gangs have been active in the city of Santa Cruz?
Well, I think gangs is also, I mean, there's such a broad definition of just this word gang, right? I mean, a gang could be anything. Three youth are hanging out, three people hanging out together, wearing a certain identity, color, whatever. That could be constituted as a gang. Or people from a certain neighborhood that hang out with one another, that could be labeled as a gang, too. So there's all these definitions when we talk about gangs. If we talk about different barrios that have existed in impoverished neighborhoods in Santa Cruz. Now, that has gone, for decades. The immigrant population or throughout, this country continues to exist for many years. Impoverished communities exist, and people where there's disenfranchisement, where there's poverty, there's always going to be, or also where there's unemployment, there's going to be young people finding alternatives in order to keep themselves busy. So that's existed here in Santa Cruz for decades already. You could say even from the early 60s.
And so despite, I don't know, there's a film at the film festival, The West Siders. There's a lot of discussion about The West Siders. There is a Norteño gang founded that is not new, that is specific to the west side of Santa Cruz.
No, and there's actually a few Norteño gangs that have existed in Santa Cruz. There was a gang called West Side before. I mean West Side, but there was also North Side. That used to frequent around the Ocean Street area. So there's been several Norteño gangs around the neighborhood. Norteños have existed in Santa Cruz for decades already.
And Holly, working on the west side and working with students at Natural Bridges High School, what Tomas brings up is super important. We're talking about whether, there's all these labels get thrown out. Oh, gang member, right? The paper here that we're looking at says bona fide gang member, and there's gang affiliated, there's suspected gang member, there's, jumped in, I am, active gang member. Yeah. And there's all these labels, and there's also wannabe gang member. And I want to just, take all those labels together and be realistic about, who we're dealing with and what.
Yeah. I've been teaching in Santa Cruz for 10 years now, and on the west side, I mean, kids who have lived there all their life, not all of them, but some of them wear red just because it's SoCal High's, or not SoCal High, Santa Cruz High's color, or it just is the color of the west side. And they don't necessarily try to be a gang member or think of it as a gang. It's more like, this is my color, this is where I'm from. They want something to identify with. And I think that's a big part of it. Kids want a sense of belonging wherever they live. They want to claim their neighborhood, and I think this upsurge in sort of fear has made a lot of the students I work with feel extra powerful. Like they're like, oh yeah, wearing red's bad, and we have a dress code at school, and we're always like, you can't wear your red belt, you can't wear your boxers that are hanging out, and it sort of gives the kids a sense of power now. They're, oh, it's bad. There's something bad about this. And it's more of a bully thing with a certain kind of high school kid. I don't see it as much of a gang.
So to a certain extent, you're seeing the kind of hysteria around gang violence actually pushing kids and contributing.
Perpetrating the problem a little
Interesting.
Bit.
Interesting. And that's part of why I asked Tani to come on and speak to the downtown scene in terms of what employees are hearing. My understanding is you attended a presentation from the police department.
Mm-hmm. The bar where I work, and as I said, it's part of a company that has a couple different bars downtown, and have seen some fights and violence outside. And so we recently were all required to attend a presentation by the police department about identifying gang members. And I mean, they, you know, went over just a lot of kind of information about identifying and whatnot. But one thing that really stood out to me when they were giving this presentation, and it was said kind of offhand, and nobody else really seemed to even take note of it, but it stood out to me, was they kind of mentioned some of the recent violence, and this was previous to the latest slaying, but it was in the wake of Tyler Tenorio's death and everything that had happened with that, and they were talking about, they basically explained that their view of things is that there are kind of like, you know, local white surfer kids who are not realizing that by claiming red and claiming West Side that they are talking about anything more than surfing at Steamer's Lane. And the police were basically saying, you know, oh, well, these kids just are really clueless, and they think that they're just talking about, you know, which side of town they like to surf on. And then they're getting, you know, caught up in this gang violence unsuspecting. And to me, that seemed like a really overly simplistic explanation of things. And you know, there have been some recent articles in the paper that have been kind of addressing, you know, there was one titled Cultures Collide about a week ago, that gave a long explanation, I think in part fueled by interviews probably with the police department and their explanation of things. Again, saying, you know, I mean, there, I can actually read a little piece from this.
Please,
there's one little paragraph that says, the images both groups project, we're talking about, you know, just West Siders who have local pride versus West Side Norteño gang members or, you know, Sureño gang members. It says, the images both groups project, red shirts and territorial claims, joking or not, to the west side of town, are so similar, gang members looking for a fight may never know if the person they attacked is a gang rival or just a Steamer Lane surf rat. But to me, it seems like, like I said, a bit of an overly mm-hmm. simplistic explanation, and that maybe the kids involved are not quite as clueless as they're being portrayed.
Well, and not to mention a double standard, and Tomas, you might have something to say about this in terms of the brush that gets painted in the media or by the police department when someone is called, you know, a gang member or a gang associate. You know, there's gang statutes and there's gang enhancements and there's a kind of throw the book at them mm-hmm. justice sense from, you know, a certain segment of the public that brush doesn't seem to be evenly spread.
No, definitely not. And those points are important that were just brought up. You know, when we look at Latino youth and black youth, usually it's with stigmatization, especially when they're involved in the so-called gang lifestyle, cholo lifestyle, the tag lifestyle, all that could be criminalized, right? And not saying that some of these young people are not involved in violence or drug activity, you know, it's not to discount that. But all that exists within all race groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
White kids do it, black kids do it, Latino kids do it, and through different extent, right? Some can just be getting involved, some can be just like innocent tagging, but you know, other group segments get criminalized more than others, and media has a lot to do with that, you know. And one thing that we've noticed here in Santa Cruz is that parents are in denial about their involvement that their youth or their children are involved in.
That's
you know?
Sure.
And so we really have to bring it up, you know, because there's a lot of young people also in the Latino neighborhoods and Latino communities also that are not involved in that sophisticated level as it's portrayed in the media.
Mm-hmm. Holly said, that's for sure.
Yeah. As a teacher, I have a lot of parents up in arms. You know, why can't my student wear red or blue to school? And honestly, it's to keep your child safe. And, you know, it's hard to be the enforcer of dress codes all the time, but it is a safety measure. But when parents don't understand, you know, and we have to really explain to them, well, are you accusing my kid of being a gang member? And I do think the media has led to a lot more hysteria about this. And it's hard to explain to parents, you know, the need for dress codes and things like that.
Well, and some of those markers in terms of what kinds of things show up in dress code are what the police were talking about in the presentation, right? To downtown, you know, I'm assuming like mm-hmm. bartenders, waiters, waitresses,
mm-hmm. Door guys.
Yeah.
Bouncers.
And I hesitate to say there's a place for that in terms of just being aware and understanding that it's a reality. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with informing people and everybody knowing, you know, a little bit more about what's happening in their community. But it seems like, you know, the presentation they're giving that's being parroted by the local media isn't giving any context. It's just kind mm-hmm. of this flat, like, I mean, Tawny, what did they expect you to do with that information?
Well, it was interesting because they were suggesting, you know, that we use these as kind of enforcement measures, maybe create a dress code. But they were very specific from the beginning of the presentation in telling us that they were talking about Latino gangs. And you know, all the pictures of people, everything, it was very specific. We were talking about norteños and sureños and nothing else. And, you know, people actually started questioning, you know, well, like, you know, somebody that works there, he's like, well, does that mean I can't wear my red Converse to work? And you know, there was a little bit of a question hanging in the air about, like, well, is this specifically targeting? And actually the owner of the bars at one point raised her hand and was like, you know, it seems like, how do we do this, you know, enforcing any of this without it becoming complete racial profiling?
Which is a damn good question.
Yeah. And so I'm not really sure what the, you know, what the expectation was. Both of these bars are kind of not the kinds of places that you would expect to have a full-on intense dress code, no colors allowed. You know, it's not the kind of places that you would expect that from. But that's basically, you know, they were basically telling us to apply it selectively. And they were, you know, I mean, obviously they weren't telling us exactly what to do, but that was the implication, was apply it selectively.
So, Tomas, a little bit about, you know, double standards here. This article has, the Sentinel article that Tawny was mentioning has a picture in it. There's a, essentially what to me looks like a gang tag, a territorial claim, in response to the death of Carl on the west side. And it says, you know, what does it say?
R.I.P. Carl.
R.I.P. Carl.
Love you, homie.
Love you, homie. The newspaper calls that a painted tribute. My expectation would that it would have referred to graffiti or a territorial claim or a gang tag or, you know, some kind of that it would have been captioned differently, I guess, is my point.
I mean, you see that in many neighborhoods where a young person was killed, slain, or just died from natural causes, right? You see graffiti pieces posted up all over East Oakland. R.I.P. Oscar Grant. Mm-hmm. You know, so for there to be an R.I.P. symbol of this young man's name doesn't implicate him, or doesn't refer. I mean, it shouldn't refer to him as a gang member, but it just shows the way that media hypes up these so-called connections. But it is important also to I wanted to bring up a point right now when Holly was speaking.
Yeah.
And she was talking about also, you know, the way young people are treated different. I was looking at the statistics in the actual homicides that took place in Watsonville and Santa Cruz. And actually, they've been, through the years, they've been pretty much stable. And actually, they've been in a decrease if you look at them through the early 90s when there was a rise in gang violence throughout the state. So mm-hmm. if you look at Santa Cruz and Watsonville compared to other communities, especially like Salinas and maybe Oakland and other, I mean, our rates are pretty low, right? But, and that's because, and a lot of this doesn't get exposed in the media because usually when those homicides or those murders take place and it happens within the Latino community, they're always, you know, it doesn't make front pages. It's always kept in the back somewhere. Mm-hmm. Young people get arrested. So what? Let it happen there. But once young people, once it's across race and mm-hmm. young people from different ethnicities or backgrounds are involved that are not Latino and now involved, you know, kids from the West Side, the Caucasians in particular, then it makes headlines. Then you have all this community outcry and these civic engagements. And so I just want to point out that, you know, if you look at the trends, there has not been a spike in gang violence, but now you see, because of this racial difference, now a spike in repression. And you see that recently with the article that came out, I think it was yesterday, the day before yesterday, where now they want to get ICE and immigration enforcement, you know, to partake in the repression against gangs in this community.
And I don't necessarily think that publicity is a bad thing. I think it's great that people are bringing this to the table and coming together and talking about what can we do. We don't like seeing our youth dying. You know, violence is sort of perpetrating more violence, you know, and they're gang issues and side issues that continue and have been going on. But getting it to the table and educating people and ignorant parents and, you know, who are your kids associating? What are teenagers doing these days? It's not a bad thing that there's publicity, but I do think that people need to understand that this is not a new phenomenon. Don't freak out, you know, don't think, you know, everybody's becoming a gang member.
Well, and so the we're getting to an important point, which is how people respond, right? There's a tendency on behalf of one group to step up enforcement measures and have police repression, you know, talking about criminalizing youth and really aggressively going after, so-called criminal organizations or just general repression and what that looks like on a street level. Is a lot of harassment. The opposite or the other hand is folks who see the larger view, what kind of intervention strategies might be more effective than a bunch of new cops or stopping every kid that you know can be profiled effectively or harsher penalties or gang enhancements. What other options should, you know, concerned parents, community members, listeners to the radio station, what rather than, you know, jumping to harsher penalties, what other options do we have for these students?
As an educator, I think communication skills are most important in parent-child communication, in dealing with violent situations, how to walk away, how to be okay with walking away. Learning nonviolent communication is important, and I don't think it's something we teach enough in the schools. I see a lot of teenagers just going out looking for fights on the weekends because it's entertainment, you know, and if there's more communication or education around how to deal with confrontation in a more meaningful way.
And Tomas, of course, the Brown Berets are organized as another option in terms of a youth organization, unaffiliated, seeking to provide, you know, some alternatives and another path, another way. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that the Berets and other folks do that has met with some success, has been effective with some of these youth?
For sure, definitely. But also want to point out that I think the most important factor here is to look at the condition of our schools, right, and the condition that teachers are subjected to, the underfunding, the amount of stress that our teachers are under, the workload that they're given. All this has an effect of the way the young people interact with another, the way they interact with their community, the employment opportunities. So if we were to invest more money in schools rather than law enforcement, I think you'll see a tremendous difference there. And then also programs in the community as well. Programs like Barrios Unidos, other programs in Watsonville, those kind of nonprofit organizations, and although I don't agree entirely that nonprofits are the solution, or that all nonprofits are effective, I believe that there still has to be more money and support into these programs.
And they're sure as hell struggling right now.
For sure. Yeah. And then, like you said, non-traditional grassroots organizations need community support as well, like the Brown Berets. The Brown Berets have done tremendous work in the community of Watsonville. For one, starting their bike program that they have, which allows young people to get involved, creating alternatives for gas, learning how to take care of the environment, learning some work skills, but at the same time learning to interact with other young people and adults in the community and opening their minds to political issues, to cultural issues that they might not have been aware of before, and exposing them in ways that they can change their community and exercise their energy to make changes.
Yeah, I think kids need a sense of belonging and going regularly to a bike class or any sport activities or any sort of after-school program. Kids identify with that. They just want a place to belong, something to claim, someone who cares about them they can see regularly. So I do think all those things, if they got more funding, teenagers wouldn't feel so bored and angry, you know.
Well, so there's the argument that there's just not enough for these kids to do, that some of them are just, you know, not as much bored as much as, like, yeah, the teen center gets cut or closed, or the after-school program, or the school just doesn't have funding, class size is huge, and there's certainly, you know, that intervention strategy is the front line of, like, let's keep these kids busy. Mm-hmm. There's also what Holly's saying, that we want to have, you know, more intervention in terms of effective communication, just like teaching them how to relate, making sure that kids are comfortable, that young men and women are comfortable backing down or not just jumping.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, a whole segment of people who just say, oh, well, you know, no matter how many alternatives you provide, there's still going to be those kids. You know, there's still going to be, you know, someone who goes looking for trouble and someone who goes, you know, and sets this organization up or who's, you know, hooked and, you know, no amount of midnight basketball or open hours at the Boys and Girls Club is going to keep this guy from, you know, thieving to get his fix. So, you know, without painting too bleak a picture, what more can we do? Because I feel you, Tomas, when you're saying, you know, nonprofits aren't the only answer, right? There's got to be more, and there's got to be some direct intervention that doesn't look like either, you know, a community center or the cops. What else have we got?
What I see, people want someone to blame this on. Oh, it's because there are no after-school programs. Oh, it's because there are more Latinos in town. Oh, it's because of this or that. But really, I think those people who are looking for someone to blame aren't doing anything themselves to reach out to a teenager, to even parent their own kids. And I think there really is a big fear of teenagers. And I was afraid of teenagers till I started teaching teenagers, you know, and I love teenagers now. And I think people, you know, if they reach out to other people's children or their own children and just make a connection so kids have other adults to talk to besides their parents or community members they can go to when they're having a tough time. You know, connections are really important, and teens need to be listened to and valued and not feared, because I really see that. They get more power when people fear them, you know. What, oh, old lady?
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
It's scary. So I think we need to support them more.
Tomas, your thoughts?
I think that's a great idea, and I think there is organizations that are doing that and people involved, and there has to be more communication across racial lines, across neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about, effective communication and education, and an education campaign about, you know, the cultural differences, about factors that other people not be aware of, employment issues, immigration issues, struggles that people deal with in their everyday lives. And this could be done through grassroots media,
mm-hmm.
Community television, community discussions, and not just always just bringing in, you know, politicians to do that for us, but the actual community engaging this discussion themselves.
Well, that's somewhere where I want to go here. So a couple of the, you know, issues that we've touched on but not really gone in deep here. Revolve around race and racism, and there's this sense of a divide. Holly mentioned that it seems like there's an increasing presence or Latino population or direct involvement, and that there may be some backlash there is what it seems like we're hinting at. And then there's also this question of neighborhoods and a segregated society. And so in addition to, you know, more education and talking to affected parties, I also want to get information about there so that people can step out of, people who are uninvolved can step out of ignorance and take some responsibility for setting up the situation as it is. in terms of, you know, why are our neighborhoods so segregated by race? That's going to contribute to a situation like this where, one, there's territorial claims. Two, there's, you know, neighborhood organizations that compete. And three, we have situations like, I just want to lay out, you know, a little bit of just geography for Santa Cruz High, for example, which is the center of a lot of this because it's, you know, it's the local high school. But you have a lot of students who live either downtown or on the west side. You have a lot of students who live in the flats. And historically, the flats, you know, identifies in one way in terms of a gang affiliation. There are a couple different organizations. And maybe the west side is affiliated in a different way. And then you have all these students come into high school. Santa Cruz High's color is red. So you have largely, you know, and this is, of course, speaking in some generalizations, but you have a largely more affluent and whiter group who's, you know, proud of their school. Maybe, you know, even you could pull in the stereotype of the student athlete who's, you know, throwing their red colors. And then you have a school and an administration with impunity, like encouraged, like school uniforms, school colors. And then you have an administration who looks to gang violence and intervention and wants to crack down on some of the new kids, some of the kids that look like the stereotype of a gang or a gang member. And what I'm basically saying without saying it is that the white kids get to wear red with total impunity. In fact, it's encouraged. And the brown kids get punished for wearing blue and identifying as a gang. And what kind of a dynamic that sets up between neighborhoods, between racial groups, between, you know, students who are expected to cooperate in the classroom. So it just situations like that, that, you know, there's some history there. There's some context there. And I feel like simplistic police department, you know, like here's how to identify a gang member and, you know, the making excuses for kids who, you know, don't know what decision they're making or don't know what it means to do this or that, really just leads us to a place of, you know, helplessness where we're not involved in the community. We don't know anything about it. And so it's like, oh, we better have the cops take care of this because this is out of control. So, I don't know. I mean, I think the local media and just having a discussion, I obviously don't think that publicity is a bad thing when, you know, right, on the radio talking about it because I think that, you know, when things like this are going on in our town, that we need to be, one, informed, and two, sympathetic to making a solution that, you know, that's progressive, that looks to how we can best meet the needs of our citizens or our residents, or, you know, and that brings up just the quick word there brings up another question of, you know, all the calls for INS involvement and getting ICE in here. And I just want to throw out, too, that there's this big story in Salinas with, like, there's this huge raid and all these people, you know, being pulled out of their homes and a bunch of search warrants and a bunch of arrests and this big, long investigation. Yeah, in Watsonville, like there was a press conference, you know, earlier today. But there are all these calls for, like, more federal and you know, immigration enforcement. My understanding is that whole Salinas raid, there was one person who was undocumented. Like, it wasn't, you know, they're talking about rooting out the gangs and getting, you know, deporting criminal illegals is the terminology, and, you know, all their enforcement measures and they're coming up with one out of 40 or one out of 50 who's actually undocumented, and what does that mean for that one person?
Yeah.
So. Sorry, that was a bit of a rant.
Well, it's important because, you know, if you look at it, it's a nativist tension against recent immigrants. And if you look at even the gang culture in Watsonville, the Norteño Sureño, when that whole beef even started, it was not against recent immigrants, against, you know, people who have been here a little longer. That beef started between Southern California against Northern California. That whole demographic changed, right? Sureños are now in most communities throughout California. In Northern California, Sureños usually are people who are recent immigrants and claim suit because they believe that that represents Mexico or the south of the border. In Mexico and other community or another countries in south of the border, they consider norteños as anybody above, you know, that borderline, anybody in the United States. Mm-hmm. So there was like a big misunderstanding there. And what's happened is now that, you know, sureños right here are mostly immigrants and norteños are mainly, you know, Latinos and whites, one whites now, but Latinos who have been here much longer, for generations sometimes. And so there's a struggle, you know, a tension between there over resources, over misunderstandings, over also inner racism within a culture. And that has to be healed and taken care of. It has to be a greater understanding within the Latino community itself, right? And so now when you see white kids getting involved with that, it fuels that tension between nativists and immigrants. And young white kids feel that, you know, they can easily, you know, identify more with the norteños because there's a tension that already exists there, has been existing for years. So I think it's important to bring that discussion in.
Well,
talking about the tension in this community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be clear, what I've observed and I'd like both of you to respond actually is that if a white kid begins to identify as or with norteños, they can still do that as a white person. And in fact, they can still be anti-immigrant. They can still oppose the newcomers in ways that betray white supremacy, while still identifying with, you know, what they see as a Latino gang, because they can still, you know, oppose the Spanish speaking Latinos or the newcomers or the, you know, the more recent arrivals. And so it sets up that this dynamic that people don't acknowledge, where, you know, you can have white kids identify as members of a predominantly Latino gang and yet still be betraying quite directly, you know, a white supremacist sentiment that shows that racism in the society.
Exactly.
I mean, I have experienced students who do sort of it's an identity thing. They want to belong. Their friends are Latino, and they, after a while, start thinking they're Latino also, or they just, you know, I think it's really just wanting to belong. And I mean, I was susceptible to peer pressure as a teenager. We've all been teenagers and sort of done stupid things to fit in. And part of it's that, like, if you're drunk at a party and your friends are, you know, doing violent things, you might just jump in and get involved too. So I do think, you know, there's a substance abuse issue. It's a belonging issue. But I mean, I think part of the thing with the West Side kids who have gotten murdered lately is some of their friends are norteños. Some of, you know, they do have some allegiance with norteños and are proudly sporting red as a sort of norteños got my back sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We're one, you know, and it's a power thing, and it's, I don't know, it is dangerous.
It seems like there's a certain bit of naive playing with fire, but I also don't want to give too much credence to the, like, oh, they weren't affiliated or like there's no, because what I see is if someone is even, you know, quote suspected gang member or you know, a wannabe, and they come from one group, then it's like, oh, well, they got what they deserved. Where if someone's painted with that same brush, and again, I'm talking about that brush not being applied equally, then, you know, it's like, oh, he was just misinformed, or like, you know, I'm fully aware. I'm not trying to disrespect the families of people who are grieving and mourning. All I'm saying is that there's some, you know, this simplistic tendency to be like, who's a gang member and who's not, where, you know, it's not like everyone gets that chance to explain that, oh, while I always sported this color and while I always, you know, stood up for my neighborhood, not everyone gets a chance to say, but I wasn't really a gang member. I didn't have the tats. I wasn't jumped in. I wasn't, you know, full on. when the reality is that even tatted, jumped in youth are sometimes not like, I mean, they're not like leadership. They're not like, you know, honchos. They're not shot callers. And there's just this whole, you know, how far are you in thing that some kids don't get to explain. They're just in because their friends are.
I think it's really important to keep that perspective on the racism involved in the media portrayal of all this. Like we were talking about earlier, you know, if you know, these white kids that have gotten killed recently have been main page of the paper for days on end. City council meetings have been packed with people full of outcry. There have been, you know, this Take Back Santa Cruz group that, you know, is a whole another discussion. But, you know, going and standing on street corners. There's just been so much outcry about it. Whereas, you know, when Latino kids get killed in gang-related stuff, it's, you know, second, third page of the paper. And it's this kind of attitude of, like, somehow they deserved to die because they were, you know, involved in gangs, and they're, you know, therefore they made that choice, and therefore somehow they lose their right to live, almost, or they lose their, like, they lose the ability to count as a person in the eyes of the papers and kind of the mainstream, like, you know, what mainstream white Santa Cruz is. There's this very much an idea that you know, that if they were involved in gangs, that you know, they're a lost cause. And I think it's important to keep the perspective on, you know, like you were saying, that these kids, you know, Carl Reimer and Tyler Tenorio, their families have had, you know, their families and friends have had a lot of chance to talk in the papers about, you know, who they were and whatnot. And again, not to, you know, obviously they didn't deserve to die. Nobody deserves to die. But I think it's really important to keep that perspective on exactly that. Nobody deserves to die. And that includes kids that aren't white that are dying in this kind of violence, too. And, you know, if given a chance, like, their friends would say the same kinds of things about them, about, you know, how what great buddies they were and how much fun they were to be around. And, you know, their parents would talk about the dreams they had. And you know, there are people, there are just as many people behind all those kids grieving just as horribly as in these cases, but it's just not given the same kind of attention. It's just brushed off as something that, you know, was bound to happen, or, you know, that deserved to happen. And I think it's really important to keep in perspective the racism involved in that.
Tomas, part of the work of the Brown Berets is keeping some of those stories that Tani's saying get overshadowed alive with a Peace and Unity March. If you could talk a little bit about the history there and how some of these youth, these affected youth, some of the people who have lost their lives on the street, and how that's affected the organization and the organizing of the Watsonville Brown Berets.
Yeah, we started this march in 1994 after the deaths of Jessica and George Cortez. Jessica was 9 years old and George was 16, and they were both killed execution style in Watsonville. It was the height of gang activity in that community, and the community got together, right, first to create the march, but also to create alternatives for young people. So it wasn't just politicians, it wasn't just law enforcement getting involved, it was the community creating these showing by example, you know, what else can be done. And there was tremendous effort around there, through churches getting involved, a program starting, sports programs, all at different levels. But this march was a way to bring attention to community involvement rather than police repression. And we brought and we did this, first of all, by reminding young people that they need to understand that this race the war that was going on, it was interracial, and it has to end. We believe that a way to mend that was to identify or you know, understand our culture. And we created this march to all different neighborhoods in Watsonville, with Aztec dancers and grieving mothers. And we also created a network between these different families and trying to create solutions. So through the years, you know, there's been more people added to the list, the people who've been killed by violence, but also families getting involved and trying to find solutions as well that doesn't involve police repression.
Hey, Tomas, you're going to hear another voice on the air. This is Jessica. I just came into the studio. So I've been listening to you guys on my drive back from Watsonville because I work down there with a bunch of teenagers as well. And I've heard a lot of stories over the last couple of years that I've been working down there. And one of the things that I haven't heard mentioned yet is just that, you know, yes, the families are grieving the same, and yes, they would say the same things about their kids, and there's, you know, like you all said, that there's not the opportunity within the public media. It's more just a word-of-mouth thing when we're talking about Latino kids dying. But another thing is that the folks in the neighborhoods where this violence is going on are also experiencing a similar level of terror. There are families, I mean, you know, one girl in particular comes in and regularly tells me that that stuff's going down in her neighborhood, and she got a bullet shot through her house, even though she comes from a family of cops. But she lives down in Watsonville in some territory that's under dispute, I guess, and they're regularly having problems. And one of the things I've been thinking is that groups have been coming up in Santa Cruz that are proposing all these solutions, and I feel, or, you know, thinking that they're solutions, whatever. I feel like there are already so many solutions that have been tried and tested in communities where the youth have been dying more regularly or been getting shot up. And it's our responsibility not just to say, oh, this is new to us, let's invent a new solution, because the resources are so thick and have been, you know, decades worth of tried and tested, you know, in our neighboring communities, in our own communities. And we just need to start, like, going into the beach flats and saying, hey, so y'all have any ideas, and actually communicating with some families that have been dealing with this for longer than we have, perhaps. And the other thing that I miss this, but I feel like we haven't really talked a lot about just the larger issues of race and class. I mean, part of solving this crisis is dealing with the economics. And the fact that if folks can't earn a legal wage or a legal living wage, they're going to turn to drug trade. And that's a lot of what gangs are about as well.
No, we did bring up those issues. About,
okay.
First of all, starting with the education system, investing money in schools, improving schools, improving the pay that teachers get.
Yeah,
and
I heard that part, and I agree so much.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I mean, I've been thinking about it. I mean, I've been complaining all year about the fact that my classroom started out with 50 kids in it in the beginning of the year, and that's just not right under any circumstances. And yet, I never saw that happen in Santa Cruz. I only saw it happen in Watsonville. So certainly, I heard you address that part.
So definitely, you know, more opportunities for employment, giving young people jobs, all this, you know, and jobs, not these medial jobs, menial jobs as well, but jobs that can actually teach skills and open opportunities for careers. These are the type of things we need to be investing
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. And personally meaningful jobs as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think alternative ed, I'm a teacher at Natural Bridges High School on the west side, and alternative ed is really trying. I think Michael Watkins is doing a good job at the County Office of Ed, making our schools smaller and providing opportunities for job training, for hands-on learning, for gardening, bike maintenance, construction, and adding those more realistic classes where kids are learning trade skills and having time to get involved in new hobbies, I think is really important. And it is too bad that you had 50 kids in your class. That's wrong. I think all kids need opportunities, not just the ones who are messing up, you know. And I do think it's a good point.
Well, and earlier I mentioned, you know, a bit of devil's advocate, but saying, you know, that this strategy, that strategy sounds good in terms of trying to get... I guess my point is that at a certain point, it's already too late by high school for some kids, and it really does start. You know, some of these issues start coming up for students way earlier than that, and by the time we have, you know, a teen center or an alternative high school, some of these issues have already come up. Some decisions have already been made, and it's obviously, I'm not saying it's never too late to make a change in life, but I mean, more jobs isn't going to help middle schoolers who, you know, who are facing some of these decisions in terms of drug trade, in terms of neighborhood involvement. and just seeing what's around them, you know.
But jobs for their parents so that their parents can pay for dance lessons or karate lessons or whatever else might. And so it's, I'm thinking like community wide, I'm thinking much bigger picture than just like targeting high school students.
In terms of overall, I mean, like, yeah, looking at the economic
picture. We need to look at the issue of gangs specifically, clear. Okay. I think everybody in town agrees on that, but there's a larger social dynamic at work that's setting that up. And you mentioned a little bit about like, let's look at the dynamics that make this whole issue come up in terms of neighborhoods, but let's also look at it in terms of state and federal. I mean, some of these, you know, Norteño Sureño issues that you guys were talking about before I got in about the, you know, more native folks and the white folks identifying with gangs that have been traditionally Latino, it's like, you know, I'm thinking back to last week's interview where we're talking about sealing off the borders and naturalizing or starting on the process of naturalization of all the people who are currently here. It's kind of like, wait, there's something going on. Like, are we, you know, is the federal government also identifying with 14 now?
Oh, you mean in terms of the sense of manner proposal and
yes,
like an amnesty,
yes,
proposal or whatever?
Yes. Huh. So, yeah, I mean, it's obviously not exactly a clear parallel, but it just gets my mind thinking, like, so what's with this whole fear of folks south of the border? And then once they cross north, give them a couple years and then suddenly they're okay. Like, I just don't get it. But there are larger societal issues contributing to these localized phenomena.
Well, in San Francisco, I was going to look it up and read more about it, but I know they can't afford to run summer school in San Francisco.
Here too.
And what the city has done is they expanded Parks and Rec. So at mm-hmm. least San Francisco, you know, they're hiring 85,000 people or something to teach, or maybe they're serving 85,000 kids, but they're mm-hmm. they're doing offering all kinds of summer programs to keep students or teens involved in activities, you know. So, you know, instead of eight new cops, how about eight new summer programs, you mm-hmm. know, and then teens will have more things to do. But, you know, money could be put somewhere a little more proactive mm-hmm. than reactionary.
I gotta say, I mean, there's something about, you know, like when I think back to my own childhood, I grew up fairly low on the economic spectrum, and we didn't have after school care, and we just like rode our bike to the candy store. Like, we didn't see our parents until like 6, 7, 8 p.m. at night, and we did just fine. And it gets me thinking, you know, I don't know what the difference is, but I wonder if there's something to do with just kids learning communication skills and learning how to get by mm-hmm. that we could be teaching them at a very, very young age. And you guys talked a little bit about like parenting stuff, and there's something to be said for just trusting kids to, like, you know, smoke a cigarette and think that, like, that's a really big deal. You know what I mean? As opposed to, like, getting into a gang war or flirting with much bigger things. So, you know, I'm not sure what's changed and what's kind of just kids will be kids, but
I got to go pretty soon. But I just want to say a few more things before I get off the phone.
Great.
I just wanted to say also that this is not going to be a quick fix. You know, many people in this country, I mean, always have a quick solution, you know, just that whole fast food mind frame, you know what I mean? This is going to be a long-term and a consistent struggle in order to, you know, change these conditions in our society. Because immigration is going to continue. As long as there's capitalism, there's going to continue to be shifts in populations around the world trying to survive,
mm-hmm.
right? So as long as there's unemployment, these issues are going to continue. As long as there's homelessness, as long as there's drugs, all these issues are going to go on and on. So it's going to take long-term, consistent struggle. And we already know that repression, it does not work. The Justice Policy Institute has put plenty of research out. Our prisons are overpacked, overcrowded. You know, they're just creating, they're actually making the condition worse. So it's going to take community involvement, it's going to take media, it's going to take addressing issues of sexism, of homophobia, it's going to take growing our own food, it's going to, all these different fronts in order to deal with these issues. And as long as we want a quick solution, we're never going to get it. So if you really want to see a change in our community, be ready for the long haul.
Yeah.
What it sounds like is and to second that, gang violence and street-level violence seems to be a symptom rather than a problem.
Exactly.
you know, it, we're talking about a more holistic approach to the economics, to the immigration policy, to funding for education. And there's all these factors that we're bringing up and bringing in that all contribute to, you know, when there isn't a value placed then and a place for students or for young people to express themselves that seems productive or that seems, you know, one way or another, you know, it's as I said, it's a symptom. It's a symptom of other injustices. It's a symptom of and instead of focusing on, you know, how are we going to combat gang violence, it's like, no, how are we going to provide, you know, alternatives or a valued place for young people in our society.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to remind people that Santa Cruz is not a bad place to live. You know, a student the other day said, this town is so boring, you know, and really it's number two in recreational cities in the country. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things to do. And I've taken students up for hikes in the forest, and some of my students had never seen the Redwoods and never known that we have these awesome trails. And now they're taking their friends and going for hikes, you know, mm-hmm. and learn to surf, go explore the you know, town has a lot to offer.
Absolutely.
And you can also say that about Watsonville. You can
Absolutely.
Also say that about East Oakland. You can
yeah.
also say that about Salinas.
Right.
You know, there's beautiful communities out there, culture,
yeah.
and families struggling to survive day to day, and yeah. that's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to thank everybody today.
Thanks,
thank you, Daniel-san. Thank you, Holly, and all the compañeras that are in the radio today.
Absolutely. Right. Tomas, thanks for your time.
La
we appreciate
lucha continua.
Okay.
Claro que sí.
All right. Gracias.
All right. So yeah, that's an important point to close on, and we do have to wrap up. It's a matter of understanding that we're not trying to demonize a population. We're not trying to, you know, point fingers at this is the issue, this is the problem. It's a matter of seeing the holistic view and seeing this as a symptom of some other injustice, some other, you know, problems that we're looking at. How we organize our economy, how we organize our education system, how we organize our neighborhoods, our urban planning even. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
If I can remember. Oh, I think some young people think that this problem is never going to get solved. And I've heard teens, when I say, what can we do about, oh, there are always going to be gangs. But if we could actually envision reducing, you know, do you think within one generation we could have a significantly less violent youth population, mm-hmm. or the gang crime, or this issue, can we reduce it, or is it going to perpetrate on? And in order to reduce it, we have to keep this level of attention on the issue, and not just, okay, put it back to the back pages of the newspaper. So
yeah, definitely. I think there's something that's quantitative about it, right? I mean, we can look at homicide rates and, you know, police statistics and all of that, but there's also something very qualitative about it, where we just start to look at what are the attitudes in town, and how do folks tend to build local culture. Mm-hmm. And we might not be able to really register that and say, you know, in 15 or 20 years something definitely shifted. It might just be qualitative. And that's okay. I think what Tomas is saying, that we're in it for the long haul, is really important.
That's true.
Well, and are we looking at reducing gang violence, or are we looking at reducing youth violence?
Yeah.
Or
mm-hmm.
are we looking at reducing unemployment? Are we looking at reducing, you know, incarceration rates? Like, again, it's like, are we trying to attack gangs? No, we're trying to attack the way society is organized, that, you know, we have youth that are drug addicted, that are looking to drugs as their only optional, you know, work and income, and just not seeing some of the rest of society access to other parts of the world, other parts of society.
Mm-hmm.
Healthy Santa Cruz.
And all of this not to say that, you know, our gang, like our TIP, Together in Peace, and our PAL, I can't remember what that acronym stands for, but both of them are gang intervention strategies that are at my school. Our grants just got canceled. And I gotta say, like, I know a kid whose family is generations back in a Norteño gang, who went up to San Francisco into the Opera House and saw the play Wicked and stayed in a fancy hotel in San Francisco, all because of the TIP grant. She'd never seen that shit before. Like, that was amazing for her. She came in with a smile all the way across her face, wanted to tell me everything about it. And it's not to say that, you know, engaging in that culture will change her gang affiliation or anything like that, but just opening kids' eyes to new things is really important. And I think that, you know, when we see those grants canceled, there is something effective about those programs, and I think we do need to prioritize them a little bit more high. So even though, you know, I'm advocating for the big picture solution, I'm also looking at the small picture.
And anyone can help a kid along or change a kid's life, you know.
Yeah.
You take someone and show them how to surf or teach them how to ride a bike or take a kid from Watsonville to the beach, you know. It can make a big difference.
Or take a kid from here, you know, from downtown Santa Cruz to Watsonville and
right.
be like, hey, check it out. This
right.
is the bike shack. Or,
yeah.
you know, hey, check it out. This is whatever. And, you know, you name it. But it's just as much about white folks getting down there as brown folks getting up here and everything in between.
Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for participating and speaking. I appreciate everybody being on the air here.
Ditto.
Thank you, dude.
Free Radio 101.1.